Hello there, you're with Extra with me, Geraldine Doogue, bringing you just some of the people and the stories that excite me each week. So great to have your company for the next half hour. First are some views of the world if you're a European diplomat, and a French one at that. You may have read, as have I, some of the first-hand accounts about the shifts in the tone within one of Australia's most popular tourist tracks, France, especially Paris. And from what I've heard and read from returning travellers, you'll see armed police and soldiers and equipment like APCs, armoured personnel carriers, in some of the beautiful squares. And you'll sense a less carefree attitude than in the past, as France, its politicians, its people, grapple with generalised fears of terrorism at levels they simply never had imagined. Then there's the sluggish economy, unemployment at 9.9%, all contributing to the debate about immigration, multiculturalism and national identity, none of which are easy to solve. It's centred on some big policy dilemmas, as I've heard it put. Are the young men, primarily from within, who are drawn to Islamic jihadism, Islamists transformed into radicals, or are they radicals transformed into jihadists? Think about that. There's quite a distinct difference. And what you do rests on the answer you choose. Well, next year, the French will elect a new president to preside over all of this, with former President Nicolas Sarkozy and Marine Le Pen of the far-right National Front both vying to be candidates. And of course, this sits slap-bang in the middle of all the turbulence that seems to be washing over the world. And France likes to consider itself in the centre of it all. Well, joining me now to offer his insights is a passionate Frenchman, Jean-David Levite, who's had a long and distinguished career with the French Foreign Service, visiting now as a Lowy Institute Distinguished European Fellow. Welcome, Ambassador.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
So what is the main message you'd like the Australian people to think about in terms of this? What could be a very important election for matters beyond France, it seems to me, next year?
Yes, we are in Europe in the process of a number of elections and votes. Of course, it started with the Brexit vote, which came as a surprise, as a shock for all of us, which shows how the populist movements are on the rise throughout Europe. And then we will have a referendum in Italy about the change of the constitution. Then we'll have elections in the Netherlands, where the populists are very strong. Then our elections, presidential elections, in May. And we'll have probably Marine Le Pen, the far-right candidate, in the second round of our election. She will not be elected, that's for sure, as president. But nonetheless,
sure?
Yes, I'm sure. I'm sure because when we'll have a second round, then the second candidate participating in the second round, the other candidate, will get the support of everybody else. And that happened already in 2002, when the father of Marine Le Pen was a candidate, and Chirac got 82% of the votes at the time. So we are certain, but nonetheless, we should not underestimate the strength of the populist movement in France. And then we have the elections in Germany, where for the first time you have a populist movement on the rise at a level which is below, around 10%, but nonetheless, it's a new development. Why do we have these populist movements? Because of the economic situation, as you mentioned, but number one, because there is a sense of loss of control of our destinies and loss of control of our borders with the flow of migrants, 1 million in Germany, in only a few weeks.
But what can I just interrupt? Because in the lecture you gave at the Lowy Institute this week, you had a very interesting way of putting it, I thought. You said people have the feeling that their leaders have lost control of a transformed world. And that was a very, I thought, interesting specific diagnosis.
Yes, and if you look at the US, in my view, it's the same. When you look from France, from Europe, at the US, you see it's a great country, the country of Apple, Google, Facebook, Amazon, the country where the banks have magnificently recovered from the financial crisis, where the unemployment is around 5% only. When you are in the US, you see that there is a lot of anxiety, frustration, the sense of a loss of control by the government about this transformed world. The US was in charge, in a way, during the decade after the explosion or implosion of the Soviet Empire. It was the unipolar decade. The US was the hyperpower. Not anymore. You have the rise of China, Russia is on the move, and so on. And the economy is now globalized. Who is in charge? Who is the cop of our planet?
Well, did we have to have a cop for the sake of argument? I mean, that's the interesting question, isn't it?
Yes, but if you are an American citizen and you considered that, well, your country was the leader of the world and suddenly
made you feel very
not
safe.
Anymore, then it creates the sense that you lost something. But beyond, the sense that globalization, in economic terms, was a bit unfair for the white male miners in the mines and so on and so forth. And you don't transform a miner in a mine into a geek, into somebody...
Who delivers services to somebody for tourism.
Well, exactly.
See, you say we have to accept that the golden decade that followed the collapse of the Soviet Empire will never come back. We have to accept that our world will remain more complex, more fragmented, full of uncertainties and shocks. So how do you ideally think leaders of the future ought to speak to their peoples then, to encourage them to be, what is it, more resilient, more relaxed about these likely shocks?
Well, it's very important, and this is true especially in Europe these days, that our leaders give the impression through tough decisions that they take back control on first our borders. And that's what they have decided to do. On October 1st, an agency of border guards for the 28, soon 27, European countries has been established. And they are in charge of the external borders of the EU, Greece, Italy, Bulgaria. Because you cannot forget about the borders inside, what we call the Schengen area, where you can go without a passport from Madrid to Paris to Berlin. That's great. But if you don't control the outside border, then you create the feeling that Europe, the EU, which was a kind of shield to protect 500 million Europeans against the excesses of globalization, suddenly becomes an aggravating factor of the negative effect of globalization. So protection is the number one demand. Number two, we must do something about the economy. And now there will be a Brexit negotiation, unfortunately. It will absorb a lot of time and energy for all European leaders. But it is at most important, it is really important that the 27 leaders show determination to solve the problem of unemployment, which is much too high, not only in France, but also in Italy, in Spain, Portugal, Greece, elsewhere. And in my view, you will see a greater integration of the Eurozone area. Greater integration.
Really? Because some people think quite the reverse.
And let me explain why in few words. Because of the Brexit, the question of the very survival of the EU is at stake. And we know that we have to demonstrate to our public opinion, to the young generation, that yes, there is a future with the EU. I said, number one, better control of our external borders to save the Schengen area, the free travel area throughout Europe. But the second one is to make sure that the economy is in a better shape. And for that, we, as countries belonging to the Eurozone, need to move fast forward with the integration. We are halfway only in the project of the Euro. Why? Because Germany is reluctant to go beyond where we are, because some countries like mine, France, have not implemented the necessary structural reforms.
No. And I suppose, listening to you, I have to ask the question, and I know a lot of listeners will be saying, well, is it a bridge too far? Is this all a utopian? Is that emerging, that this can't be easily done? And it's just was asking too much to join all these groups in a really coherent, both political and financial structure.
No, I'm passionately pro-Europe. I was born just after the Second World War. My parents were victims of Nazi aggression. And for me, it's a blessing to see the Germans and the French working hand in hand, building a common future. But it's true that we have two deep divisions in Europe. The first one is about the economy. Mm. It's a north-south division. In the north, these structural reforms I mentioned have been put in place, achieved, and they are very successful. In the south, France, Italy, Spain, and so on, we have not yet adopted these reforms. That's a must for the coming months. And I'm sure that after a new president is elected in France, you will see these reforms implemented. The second division is between the east and the west of Europe, and it's about the refugees. Because in the western part of the European Union, we have absorbed millions of refugees over the past decades. Those countries which were on the other side of the Iron Curtain never had refugees from the Muslim world. And suddenly, we ask them to absorb their fair share. And they say, wow, why? So these are two debates, very difficult, but we will move on. We will succeed in finding good compromises.
Countries in the Old East are looking on as you consider this very critical question, whether the modern jihadists in France are Islamists transformed into radicals or radicals transformed into jihadists. It's a very important distinction. Now, and you know, there's no obvious answer yet, is there?
Well, I think they are radicals transformed into Islamists. And let me explain. Al-Qaeda proposed only to destroy. ISIS, the Islamic State, propose to young generations to build a caliphate, to build a future. And if you are a young, disenfranchised, living in a poor neighborhood with bad education, no job, looking at the internet and you see this propaganda, you say, wow, maybe I have a future.
So there's a positivity there with the caliphate.
Exactly.
So would you say that there are the possibilities for helping those people not to become radicalized? I mean, after all, this has been a very important part of French life, the business of young people thinking radical thoughts and moving on them.
Yes. Well, they are radicals because they are frustrated, because they have no future. They feel excluded. That's why it's so important, and we are part of a coalition, as you are, to destroy the Islamic State. That is, to destroy the places where they have built in Western Iraq and Eastern Syria, the Islamic State. We are slowly succeeding. It is difficult, but it is absolutely key.
And just very finally, you say we need ad hoc coalitions beyond Syria to address today's crises. Again, moving out of the usual.
Yes. You know, my hope is that the most experienced candidate in the US will be elected, if you see what I mean.
Yes, I do.
I'm sure that she would be leading a more engaged foreign policy. She has experienced. She's been state secretary for foreign affairs for years and years. And so she will bring more engagement from the US in world affairs. But in this transformed world, where you see the rise of China, India, Russia, it's necessary that all those who share the same values work together. And that's why I'm so pleased to see that Australia and France, for instance, are working very closely on a number of issues. That's a perfect example of what we should do.
Ambassador Levite, I know that you're also you worked with Gareth Evans 25 years ago on solving the Cambodian crisis, which looked insoluble completely. So, look, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
On RN, you're listening to Extra, the best of Saturday's show, with me, Geraldine Duke. Well, with the US election now less than a month away and the campaign moving up into fifth gear, it's time to launch our Election Express US edition. We're developing an idea we brought out first for our election in July. Every week on the show, we're going to take you to two different states to meet journalists and editors outside the major cities who have to be in charge or have to be in contact with their local societies in order to serve them well, to maybe tease out some different nuances to the sort of copious coverage we're getting at the moment, the repetitive coverage of a lot of the sort of big statements. In weeks to come, we'll hear from folks in Florida, New Hampshire, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. But this week we're off to the US's most northernmost state, Alaska, and the battleground state of Colorado in the Rocky Mountains. James Brooks is a political reporter for the Juneau Empire in Alaska's state capital of Juneau, and Lauren Gustus is the editor of the Fort Collins Coloradoan. So welcome to you both.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Could I seek a quick breakdown from each of you, just to get a bit of context of the politics in your particular area? Starting with you, Lauren Gustus, I know Colorado's become progressively more Democrat-leaning in recent years, but I gather that Fort Collins remains a bastion of conservative politics.
Yeah, thanks for having me. We are a changing state and we are a changing county. We did an analysis not too long ago of the complexion of our county and our state. And in the United States, we're red or blue, right? Red are traditionally Republicans, blue are Democrats, and we could not be more purple here in Larimer County, Colorado. We have a majority of folks who are undeclared, so independents. They haven't pledged allegiance or to either party, either the Democrats or the Republicans. So again, a majority of our voters are independents, which means they can change their mind and vote for any candidate they like in the primaries and certainly vote along any lines they like come the election.
Which How interesting. Because you've got an Air Force base, Air Force Academy there, haven't you?
That's actually a little farther to the south of our state, but it, certainly you do see a lot of retired military here in Colorado, and they are traditionally more Republican-leaning. And I was at an event last night, a local event, where we had a number of military members who were expressing their views on where we are headed as a state. And there are differences, certainly, between their perspectives and those of the unaffiliated.
And of course, in Denver in Colorado, you know, it's a very cosmopolitan sort of place with quite a population boom. Over to you now, James Brooks in Alaska. As I understand it, Juneau is a bit of a Democratic stronghold in a reliably Republican state.
Yes, it's almost the flip role in our neck of the woods here. We're a city of about 33,000 people perched here on the west coast of North America. There's no roads in or out, but it is the state capital. And 40% of the jobs here in Juneau are government-related, whether local government or state government. And that tends to engender a lot of Democratic support here in Juneau.
And can you see any change at the moment? I should ask you, actually, because I'm just looking at my notes, that there's quite a lot of support for the election's third candidate, who's had very little coverage here in Australia, the Libertarian nominee from New Mexico, Gary Johnson. And I understand you ran an interview with him earlier this year.
Yes, over the summer we saw the polling data that seemed to indicate as many as one in five or more Alaskans could be favoring Gary Johnson,
Goodness
the Libertarian candidate.
That's extraordinary, isn't it?
We thought so as well. We haven't seen that kind of support for a third party since 1992 when Ross Perot was running. And so we felt it was important to sit down with him and discuss, well, what do you know about Alaska? Because plenty of the candidates nationally certainly don't.
Did he know anything?
He knew some things, but he was willing to admit that that he didn't know when he didn't know things.
And why? What made him so attractive to Alaskan voters then?
You know, Alaska is kind of the off the wall, the maverick place, the rogue place, if you want to borrow Sarah Palin's line, where you have a lot of people who are trying to get away from the ordinary. And I think that carries over into politics as well as personality.
Now, Lauren, the Coloradoan, I think that's correct, which is part of the USA Today network, recently ran an article about Fort Collins millennials, we noticed, who were turning away from the big parties and considering giving their vote to this Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate. How big do you think this trend is and why?
I think that folks are, especially the millennial generation here in the United States, what we found anyhow in Colorado is that they're disenfranchised with both of the major parties, and they don't like to be put in a box, right? They don't like to have just this option or the other, and I think that's what you're seeing, what we've seen for years in our more classic and traditional political parties. So, yes, Gary Johnson, Jill Stein has also been here, and she spent some time campaigning in Fort Collins, and she's been very popular when she has come out.
Now, so tell us more about her, please, because I'm not aware of her.
She's also a third-party candidate, so she's an off-party candidate. Not got the following that Gary Johnson does, but she's also a viable candidate. She's on the ballot. There are, I think, 22 names on our presidential ballot, and there's also a spot for write-ins. So it'll be interesting to see what we see beyond the top two on the ballot. I do think that there was tremendous enthusiasm to hear for Bernie Sanders, who challenged Hillary Clinton in the Democratic primary and did not succeed, and folks still have tremendous allegiance to Bernie Sanders. So the question will be, what will turnout look like on November 8th on Election Day? Will millennials vote? Will they say, well, I'll take the lesser of any evil I might see on the ballot? Or will they kind of check out on the process and say, I don't see anything for me here. You know, maybe I'll sit this one out.
Well, I must say, I heard Barack Obama making incredibly powerful on the stump speeches, saying democracy is on the line. Everything's on the line in this. Do you think that's going to work? I'm going to go first to you, Lauren, then I'll go to James.
Yeah, we've seen...
Are they listening anymore, you know?
Yeah, that's a great question. I can tell you that the dialogue here in our community has been as strong as it has ever been around the national election, around a presidential election. Donald Trump has visited our neck of the woods, our county, and Hillary has had visits elsewhere in the state, and the rallies have sold out. You know, sold out's a relative term. Tickets are free, but they are at capacity. And so I think the interest is at a fever pitch. The concern is that come Election Day, will this candidate really represent me? You know, and that's the question that people are grappling with. I do think if you ask me personally what will happen, we'll see tremendous turnout.
You do.
But that's just my two cents.
And what do you think, James?
You know, I was just looking back at the numbers not too long ago, and it seems that in the past 40 years, we've been turnout-wise between 50%, 65% most years, and I'd be surprised if we weren't in the higher end of that, up towards the record, which is 82% turnout for the election.
So, because I've really been wondering whether the Americans... I mean, frankly, I'm sick of the coverage here in Australia. I wondered whether Americans had just thought, oh, it's all a circus and a zoo, or whether it's engaged you. So you're saying, James, you think it'll be on the high side?
I do. I think you're right in that folks are getting, they're ready for the election to be tomorrow and not November 8th, but people are still talking about it.
Okay.
On social media, on Facebook, on Twitter. If they're tired of it, they haven't stopped talking about it. They haven't stopped reading about it.
Well, I hope they do turn out. And now, well, then let's come to a sort of a conclusion by discussing how much the presidential campaign coverage is getting in your Juneau empire. I mean, given that you have, I think, only 3 electoral college votes and you're seen as reliably Republican, you'd assume the campaign isn't the big deal it is in other parts of the country. But by the sound of it, no.
Well, it depends on who you ask, but generally there's more interest in the statewide races than, or at least when I say interest, people don't think that their vote will matter nationally, but their vote will matter statewide, and so they're interested in the election because they see this on TV, but when they go out to vote, their votes will matter more at the state level.
So you've got 2 senators, haven't you?
Yes.
And what about you, Lauren? How would you say, obviously you've got a lot happening in there in Colorado, but for ordinary people?
Yeah, because we're a swing state, I think there is that idea that we do matter. Right now, Hillary has a 7.3% lead in Colorado, according to Real Clear Politics, which aggregates all of the polls that are available on a daily basis. So she's got a comfortable lead, although, you know, certainly things could change. So I think that there is that idea that, yes, Colorado matters, but there's also a really personal stake, I think, in this election, and that folks feel very strongly about one candidate or another. And you see many threads, as we talked about previously on Facebook, about why this matters to me, why I align or don't align with this candidate or the other candidate, given things that have happened or things that have been said and so on and so forth. And I think there's a very personal interest in support or lack of support for candidates that's probably having an effect across the country, regardless of how critical your state is to the process.
Yeah. And both just finally, I mean, Republican leaders, some states, some federal, in both Alaska and Colorado, have said they don't support Trump in these big developments that have come post that those tapes. Do these kinds of statements have much of an influence on voters, do you judge? I mean, you obviously see the letters to the editor and so on. You're watching very closely. Or do you get a sense that your readers have already made up their mind? Lauren, to you first.
That's a really good question. You know, I don't know that a Republican, so for example, we have a Senate candidate who is denounced Donald Trump and says, you know, I don't align with him and his values and so on and so forth. I would suppose that that's reassuring for some Republicans in our state. I do think, too, that there are many Republicans in our state and Democrats in our state who are going to vote the party line because that is the way that they have always done it. And so I don't know how difficult that is to essentially change allegiances, you know, on a candidate-by-candidate basis, just because the candidate has denounced Trump. That's a good question. I don't know. It'd be interesting to see how things turn out where we do have those races that are at risk at the Senate and House level across the country.
Yes, it will. James, what do you think?
Yes, I do think it matters because here in Alaska, both our U.S. senators and our representative in the House of Representatives have either said no Trump at all or they've said I'm not supporting him. And but I think the general sentiment is that because Alaska is so distant, because it is so small, I mean,
no one's visited you, I read.
Exactly. We're a half a percent of the Electoral College here. And there was an interesting comment from a woman named Hannah Davis, who I talked to locally here. She said, the most comforting thing about this election is that it's out of our hands.
Very interesting. My goodness. Okay. Look, I appreciate you your time very much. Thank you to you, James.
Thank you.
And Lauren, to you, thanks again.
Thanks for having us.
Good luck. James Brooks from the Juneau Empire in Alaska, Lauren Gustus, editor of the Fort Collins Coloradoan. I'm Geraldine Doogue. I do hope you can join me at the same time next week or online via the RN website.